This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Professor Mark Crispin Miller from NYU on the perilous situation that WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange finds himself in. We also speak with Professor Miller about voter suppression and the consolidation and decline of the media. We welcome back to Law and Disorder law professor Catherine Franke, who 2 months ago was barred from entering Israel and told to never come back. A quite sizable campaign in her defense developed both in the United States and in Israel.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
WikiLeaks founder, the truth-telling publisher Julian Assange, is in escalating danger of being sent from England to America, where he would likely be tried for espionage, a crime that carries the death penalty. Assange and WikiLeaks have revealed American war crimes in the Middle East, CIA global machinations, and the work of the Clinton Democrats in preventing the popular Bernie Sanders from heading up the party ticket. Assange is presently holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he was granted political asylum 6 years ago by past leftist president Rafael Correa. But now, with the change of presidents in Ecuador, Assange has been cut off from the outside world. He has no phone, no computer, and no visitors. The fresh offensive against him occurred the day after American General Joseph DeSalvo, the head of the U.S. Southern Command, the Pentagon's arm in Latin America, visited the new right-wing Ecuadorian President Lenin Moreno. Moreno has said that Assange is, quote, an inherited problem, and is seeking a better relationship with the United States government, to whom he has already granted a military base. Here to speak with us today about the danger to Julian Assange and to independent media is Mark Crispin Miller, who is a professor of media studies at New York University. Professor Miller has frequently spoken out about media propaganda, the engineering of consent for empire, fake news, and the destruction of the independent press. He has been awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship for the Humanities and is a vigorous defender of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. Mark Crispin Miller, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me on.
First, let's talk about what is WikiLeaks and what contribution has WikiLeaks and its founder, Julian Assange, contributed to our understanding of the U.S. government's role in the world?
Well, it's crucial to understand the fundamental truth that WikiLeaks is a publishing organization. That's what it is. It publishes documents. It makes revelations that have been suppressed by the state so that we can get a good, clear look into the kitchen, as it were, of Western policy, especially foreign policy. It is, I repeat, a journalistic organization. Now, we tend these days, and have tended for some time, to think that journalists can only be people who've gone to journalism school, gotten duly accredited, and gone to work for one or the other of the major corporate news organizations. Okay, this would have come as news to the framers of the Constitution. Anyone who publishes information is, by definition, a journalist. So freedom of the press actually applies to any citizen of a democracy. WikiLeaks has a perfect record of accuracy, having released something like 40,000 documents over the years. Never once has anybody been able to claim, even much less prove, that any of those documents were bogus. The New York Times should boast such a stellar record of accuracy. So there's no fake news coming out of WikiLeaks. In this case, all the fake news is directed at Julian Assange.
What kind of material has WikiLeaks published, and how does that contribute to our understanding of the way the U.S. government works in the world?
Well, it isn't just the U.S. government. It's states across the board. And what makes WikiLeaks so valuable is the fact that its primary documents, stuff that comes straight from the belly of the beast, has functioned to contradict various propaganda narratives that the state puts out. Nothing could be more important than that. It seems to me that the function of real journalism is always to rebut or expose the falseness of propaganda. I mean, we're absolutely drowning in propaganda. You know, it's like a thermal inversion. So you get a kind of heroic picture of, you know, the war in Iraq, for example. We're over there fighting for freedom in some vague way. Nobody really knows why. Then you look at the gunship videos that were released by WikiLeaks. You see that it's just a slaughter. It is a matter of picking off civilians. The same with the DNC emails, which I'm sure we'll talk about more in a moment. But there we got to look at what the DNC and the Clinton campaign were really up to throughout the primary season, completely different from the spin that the establishment press was putting on that political cycle. In a way, the fact that the material that WikiLeaks gives us is unfiltered, you know, they're giving it to us straight, basically. And they're also providing a signal service to news organizations, giving them a staggering abundance of hot material that they should be using to make the truth about them clear to the larger public.
What moves are afoot to force Assange out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's taken refuge?
Well, I mean, there's obviously, you know, stuff going on behind the scenes to muscle the new government of Ecuador into turning him over. I'd even go so far as to say that the installation of this new president was probably the result of various covert activities meant to get rid of Correa, who was the one who gave Assange asylum, in favor of a head of state who would be more amenable, you know, and so on. And I can't speak really authoritatively to that because this stuff is all hidden from us. The more important and horrifying set of tactics that are being used to get Assange out of there amounts to torture, as far as I'm concerned. Solitary confinement. He's being held incommunicado. He is being denied urgent medical assistance. I mean, right before our eyes, in a way, we have this man being subjected to horrendous mistreatment that would have everybody in our establishment up in arms if it were happening to some journalist in China or, you know, Iran. But because it's Julian Assange and we think of him as a tool of Putin, I mean, there's been a tremendous amount of propaganda fog pumped at and around him. We just let it go. But it is an outrage. You know, it seems to me to be a criminal act.
Well, they've cut him off from his computer, from the outside world. No visitors, no email.
Right. Incommunicado.
He can't go outside, doesn't get sunshine, wants to go to the doctor, he needs medical care, they won't let him do it.
Right, right. It would be completely unacceptable at any of our major prisons for civilians.
Another thing that they've done to him, the British newspaper, The Guardian, is charging Assange with violating the embassy's communication system and apparently reading confidential diplomatic traffic. And Assange has been silenced, so he can't even respond to that. Do you think that this is part of the British and United States onslaught to force Ecuador to renege on its asylum, which they granted him 6 years ago?
Well, absolutely. That and the ever-expanding police presence outside the embassy, these are strong-arm tactics. That stuff in The Guardian is disinformation, okay? It can't be trusted. The Guardian is a rag, okay? It's a propaganda rag, just like the New York Times. And I'm not – this is not hyperbole, okay? It may sound extreme to people who haven't awakened to the facts, but these mainstream news organizations with their august histories are now simply conduits for state propaganda of the crudest kind. Focus Ecuador, the outfit that supposedly provided The Guardian with this information, has given them forged documents in the past. So we're talking about what amounts to an intelligence operation to basically force Assange out of that haven and into the loving embrace of the United States.
Well, that anticipates my next question. Attorney General Jeff Sessions has said that putting Assange on trial for espionage is what he says a priority, and that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has declared that WikiLeaks is a, quote, non-state hostile intelligence service. Your thoughts on that?
But that, you know, that kind of takes my breath away. What does that even mean? All they do is provide the world public with important information. You know, they don't put any troops at risk. They aren't naming intelligence officers. They're basically giving us a lot of uncomfortable truths. And in the world we live in now, that amounts to an act of terror. I think that across the board, the states that now call the shots, you know, the U.S. especially, and Britain and Israel and others, what we call the West, you know, the West is primarily engaged these days in promoting and above all protecting a set of propaganda narratives that have never been more dangerous on the one hand, and yet that have never been more vulnerable. You know, the credibility of governments, the credibility of the media establishment, such credibility has never been lower. Fewer people trust what they hear than ever before. So there's a kind of desperation, you can sense it, in the way that the government, through the corporate media, polices what we're thinking, polices what we see and read, tells us what's fake news and what isn't. And in this regard, you know, the rise of Donald Trump has been kind of a stroke of genius, because Trump, on the one hand, of course, is a pathological liar. You know, when he moves his lips, he's usually lying. The press takes great pleasure in quantifying his lies. You know, since coming to office, Donald Trump has lied 7,422 times. Okay, let's look at those lies. The lies are ridiculous, trivial, blatant. You know, practically everybody can see that they're lies, and they don't count. They don't matter. The size of his inauguration crowd, big deal. Well, all that lying of his allows the Times and the Guardian and the rest of them to get up on their high horse and posture as the champions of truth when they're the ones who are promoting lies that are far more destructive than the ones that Trump tells. First of all, because most people, at least educated people, believe them. And second of all, because they have to do with matters of life and death. You know, to lie about the chemical attacks in Syria, to lie about Russiagate, is to push war propaganda that could have really catastrophic consequences. These are huge, huge lies. And you know, these lethal lies extend into various other fields, you know, public health and so on. The fact is that both sides are lying like crazy. The system is utterly corrupt. More and more people know it. So there's a kind of hysteria, you know, that I and others can sense at the top, as the you know, material in the press has never been more false and has never been more strident in its insistence that those lies are true.
Last month, the Democratic National Committee launched a lawsuit against WikiLeaks and Assange as co-conspirators with Russia and the Trump campaign in a supposed criminal effort to steal the 2016 presidential election. In reality, what did the documents WikiLeaks published show about the DNC and the Bernie Sanders campaign?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a typical kind of a disinformation tactic to distract from the content of the information revealed to the circumstances of its release, right? So they don't want people to focus on the fact that the documents show, among other things, that the DNC was heavily biased against Bernie Sanders and did everything it could to throw the primary elections to Hillary Clinton. They also revealed that the corporate press, you know, Rachel Maddow, Maggie Haberman of the Times, all these august figures throughout the media were basically working hand in glove with the Clinton campaign, sometimes even offering to run copy past them for approval, you know, the most abject kind of servitude or we could say partisanship, that ought to have resulted in their being fired as journalists, right? This comes across in those emails, right, which WikiLeaks simply publicized.
They're saying that WikiLeaks hacked into the DNC computer.
Right.
And Ray McGovern was on our show, Law and Disorder, several months ago, explaining that the information from the DNC computer was not hacked, but leaked, and likely leaked from a disgruntled staffer.
Oh, right. This speaks to the great fog known as Russiagate. You know, we're told they hacked the election. What does that mean? Do they hack voting machines? No, Obama said. No, Comey said. They bent over backwards to say that didn't happen, because one of the big lies they tell is that it never happens. Elections are never stolen in the United States. No, that didn't happen. What happened was they flooded the atmosphere with pro-Hillary propaganda and hypnotized the electorate into favoring Trump over Hillary. And then that morphed into the $100,000 worth of Facebook ads, you know, most of which turned out not to have anything to do with supporting Trump and so on. The fact is that Julian Assange himself, Craig Murray, the diplomat who has worked closely with Assange, have both said that those emails were not hacked, that they were leaked. There was then an anonymous analysis of the data, forensic analysis of how those emails were acquired, that found that they were, in fact, leaked, not hacked. On the basis of that anonymous analysis, veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, VIPS, which is the group that Ray's part of, and there are some very heavy hitters in that group,
yeah,
including William Binney of the NSA, they confirmed, largely confirmed, the findings of that analysis, that basically the disappearance of the emails or the removal of those emails from that archive of data was too quick to have been the result of a hack. They had to have been downloaded onto a thumb drive. The likeliest candidate is, of course, Seth Rich. And if you do a search on the name Seth Rich and the New York Times, for example, there again, you'll find reams of hysterical denial that there's anything whatsoever to that. This is fake news. This is a hoax, you know. Let me say that anytime you read throughout the press that a story is a hoax and a fake and fake news and a lie and false, I think you can rest assured that it's probably true. Otherwise, they wouldn't be flipping out about it like that.
Let's talk about political asylum when it's granted and can it be taken away. I'm thinking now not just of Julian, but what the United States is doing when people and their children are coming here seeking asylum. Instead of being given a hearing on the bona fides of their contentions on why they need asylum, instead their children are being taken away from them, and then they're given a trial, and then they're sent back. What do you think of the concept of asylum, which is, I had thought, sacred in American and international law, and it seems to be being eroded?
Well, it is definitely being eroded. I would note, though, that these are actually two different things, both horrendous, and you were right to bring them both up as unacceptable, because Assange already has been granted asylum, okay? He was given asylum by the former president of Ecuador. These families that are coming to the United States, primarily because of economic and military depredations that the U.S. is responsible for, they are seeking asylum and they are being denied it. Okay, so in Assange's case, it's a question of whether or not, once you've been given political asylum, can it be taken away for political reasons? Naturally, my impulse is to say it shouldn't be. That is a hopelessly idealistic position. But the fact is, let's broaden the point you're making to say that all the usual ethical and moral norms that have either obtained or that have seemingly obtained in the West for the last century or so have been thrown out the window. And it didn't start with Trump, okay? There are a lot of people out there who think that if Donald Trump disappeared, the United States would turn into a land of peace and universal brotherhood and perfect justice. That is not the case. It was Barack Obama who was the first president to engage in the summary execution of American citizens, right? So Barack Obama actually was said by the ACLU to have the worst record on civil liberties of any president in U.S. history. So I think we can actually ascribe the torment of Julian Assange to the Obama administration. I think that they're the ones who got that ball rolling. What Sessions has done, and this is typical of the Trump administration, is to simply kick things up a notch rhetorically, you know? Obama wore a friendly mask. Trump's is the face of U.S. power without the mask.
What kind of support has been manifested for Julian and WikiLeaks, and what are you in particular doing, Mark?
Well, I mean, I'm doing what I can. I am participating in a monthly online vigil, as we call it, that Susie Dawson and Elizabeth Vos have organized. A vigil means a series of hour-long interviews online, you know, with people from across the whole political spectrum coming on to speak out in Julian's support and to talk, as we're talking now, about the implications of his mistreatment. Unity4J is the name of that online vigil or the organization that organized
it. And how do you spell that?
Capital U. N-I-T-Y, 4, capital J, numeral 4. U-N-I-T-Y, numeral 4, capital J. The World Socialist website has come out with a great article on the growing support for Julian in Australia. And Roger Waters, co-founder of Pink Floyd, has come out in support of Julian. I mean, these are the beginnings of what I hope will be a sea change on the grassroots level, to mix my metaphors. I don't think the establishment is going to change its tune, right? But what's happening overall is that establishment opinion, establishment orthodoxy, and I'm talking about what we read throughout the press, is, as it were, slowly rising off the surface of the planet, you know, rising ever higher and higher, not only from reality, but from mass opinion. They're like two different things. I mean, this may sound like an out-of-the-way example, but take the assassination of John Kennedy. By now, it's something like 80% of the American people think that Kennedy was killed as the result of a conspiracy that probably did not involve Lee Harvey Oswald. I mean, that's an amazing number, and that's been growing for some time. You wouldn't know it from reading the New York Times. You wouldn't know it from watching MSNBC or listening to NPR. Those people are living in some kind of weird time warp, you know? That example has analogs in of all kinds, right? That there's a kind of divide growing between the unreality that grips the establishment and a kind of a vague, uneasy, often uninformed, intuitive grasp of the truth.
So what can our listeners do to help?
What can they do to help? Let me see. I think they can contribute to Julian Assange's legal defense fund, which the link is on the WikiLeaks website. And they can buy stuff from the WikiLeaks shop. These are ways to help support him financially. They should also do what we're trying to do, you know, which is to share accurate information about what's happened to him. And if you don't have access to a forum like this, you spread the word about shows like this, and you let people know that there's another side to the story. There's also WikiLeaks' own tweets, which people should share, because those are pretty much authoritative. And I also would urge people to write cards and letters to Julian.
And how do you do that?
Well, here's his address. It's Julian Assange, care of the Ecuadorian Embassy, flat 3B, that's 3B as in boy, 3 Hans Crescent, that's H-A-N-S, C-R-E-S-C-E-N-T, London, S-W-1-X-O-L-S.
Mark, let me ask you to put the attack on Julian in the context of the destruction of the independent media. I'm holding in my hand a copy of the New York Times, Wednesday, June 13th, and one of the headlines is, "Merger decision is a green light for deal-making. AT&T gets Time Warner. Blow to Justice Department in case watched closely by companies." What was your reaction when you saw that AT&T and Time Warner are getting together to form one huge corporation?
Well, it was, I responded to that with an all too familiar feeling of disgust. I mean, I wasn't terribly surprised by this because these mergers have been, you know, sweeping the cultural landscape since the 90s. And I spoke out against them then, and now, I suppose I could speak out against them, but I think that battle has been lost. I mean, what this is simply going to do is further strengthen the cartel that owns the U.S. press and media generally. Something like 90% of the American press, our free press, is owned and run by some six multinational corporations.
With ties to the defense industry.
Well, I was about to say, the problem there isn't just their relentlessly commercial orientation. I mean, that would be bad enough. And traditional media criticism dwells on that aspect of the problem. It isn't just that they're too commercial and that they are impatient with material that only reaches a comparatively small audience, and that they are excessively responsive to the whims of their advertisers. It isn't just that. It's that the bigger they get, the closer they get to the state. That's the problem. We've known this for some time. They are close to the Pentagon. They are close to the CIA especially, right? And this, by the way, is not a problem peculiar or unique, I should say, to the corporate press. It's a problem that includes much of the left press as well nowadays, you know, that many left press outlets are gatekeeping outlets that are silent on Julian Assange's plight, that simply participate in the propaganda drives on Syria or, you know, Russia or whatever it is, that are silent on some of the gravest state crimes of the last half century. You know, I'm not going to name any names, but the fact is that we are living at a moment of grave crisis for real press freedom, because the state has so much power, both overt and covert, over the media, that it's extremely difficult to get at the truth, even or especially through social media, right? Because Google now has algorithms that conveniently rank dissident outlets and dissident individuals very, very low or not at all, so that if the average person, whoever that may be, goes and does a search on Mint Press News or Black Agenda Report or Counterpunch or My Name or this show.
Or this show.
This show.
Or the World Socialist Website.
The World Socialist Website. You name it. You can go page after page after page and find a lot of attacks on them, right? But you're going to have a hard time finding them, okay? That's just Google. Twitter and YouTube are taking down material, canceling accounts right and left. Facebook is now, they've teamed up with the State Department and the government of Israel to identify what they call fake news, right? Which again means Facebook users like myself and others whose stuff somehow doesn't get to most of – I have like 5,000 friends, right? When I post something, maybe 40 or 50 of them know about it, you know? And this has become, you know, really remarkably the case over the last 2 weeks or so, you know? This kind of shadow banning goes hand in hand with press attacks on dissident investigative journalists like Eva Karine Bartlett and Vanessa Bealey. The Guardian has run many hit pieces on them for offering dissident views of Syria and the White Helmets. That kind of character assassination and the use of algorithms to disappear inconvenient journalists and others is directly continuous with the brutal mistreatment of Julian Assange. When they took away his microphone, as it were, they took away his megaphone, when they silenced him, they were doing one among many things to, as I put it earlier, protect the propaganda narrative from contradiction. That's what's going on here. You know, propaganda, understand, propaganda is not persuasion. Persuasion has to do with an oratorical attempt to move an audience to a particular point of view. The premise there is that you're one of several people arguing with one another, you know, and assuming that the most persuasive argument will win. Propaganda doesn't operate that way. Propaganda isn't interested in other arguments. Propaganda doesn't want other arguments. It wants total control of the environment, okay? It does not want contradiction. It does not tolerate ambiguity. It wants absolute access at all times, right? Just as it did in the Soviet Union, just as it does in China today, so it would also do here in the so-called free world. Now, because we have a First Amendment in the United States, and we have to at least pay lip service to the ideal of the marketplace of ideas and freedom of individual expression, all these maneuvers have to take place kind of covertly and quietly and in a diffuse way. So we're not quite as aware that the gag is being tightened as young people in China are. I have a lot of Chinese students, and it's no secret to them that the Chinese state wants to control online conversation, and they do it. They have the right to do it in that country. Over here, they can't be so ham-fisted about it. You know, they have to be more cunning about it, more indirect and more piecemeal, if you see what I mean. But it is happening here, okay? And it's worse here precisely because this is the place where we're always told we do have freedom of speech, right? We pat ourselves on the back because we have a First Amendment. So that makes our negation of the First Amendment that much worse. You know, it makes our system more hypocritical, and it makes the censorship more effective because people often can't see it happening.
We've been talking with Mark Crispin Miller. Actually, an area of your expertise, and I want to tap into that before we have to let you go because we're running out of time, is voting and elections.
Yeah.
And yesterday, the Supreme Court made a decision allowing the state of Ohio to purge their election rolls if someone hasn't voted for 2 years. Right. What was your reaction to that?
Well, again, an all too familiar feeling of disgust because vote suppression by the states has been going on since 2000, primarily at the hands of the Republican Party, because the Republican Party in this century embraces a really kind of crackpot agenda that most people don't support. They therefore have no choice but try to whittle down the size of the electorate, and having done that, to manipulate the numbers on election night through electronic means. So election theft is a Republican specialty. And the vote suppression piece of it has been growing and growing since 2000. So, you know, more and more states have passed voter ID laws and laws restricting student votes and all kinds of, you know, legalistic tactics to whittle down the size of the electorate. Ohio is kind of like ground zero for this sort of thing, although it happens in other states as well. And the irony of the Supreme Court decision is that if people have missed elections in the past because the state prevented them from voting, it seems a bit perverse to then say, well, their names can be swept from the rolls because they didn't vote. I mean, the assumption there is to blame the victim, right? They didn't vote. They're apathetic, so they shouldn't have the right to vote, you know? The problem then in this case is not so much that this is a new thing, because vote suppression has been going on all over. It's epidemic, really. But that the Supreme Court has basically said, yeah, it's cool, it's fine, go ahead. I don't think that the preposterousness of the argument is a problem in their eyes. You know, what I just said about why people haven't voted, they don't care about that. It's nakedly political, nakedly partisan, nakedly anti-democratic. They just want states to be able to purge the rolls of, you know, people who are voting the wrong way, which is African Americans, Hispanics, Native Americans, and students, big part of it, union members. You know, this is part of a very, very large push to destroy – even, you know, the few pathetic remnants of American democracy that we have left. And I want to add very quickly that we cannot blame the Republican Party alone for this. The Democratic Party is complicit. They acquiesce in it. They never, ever talk about stolen elections in this country. Al Gore never talked about the evidence that his victory was stolen from him. John Kerry, who told me personally he thought his election was stolen and then denied the conversation the next day or a week later, he has never talked about the overwhelming evidence that the 2004 election was stolen by Bush Cheney. I wrote a whole book about that. And Hillary Clinton, now that we're on the subject, this may surprise many of your listeners, but if you take a look at the evidence, you look at the unadjusted exit polls, you look at the numerical anomalies in Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, and above all, if you look at the Republican Party's desperate and successful efforts to shut down the recounts requested by Jill Stein, you realize that Hillary Clinton actually won the 2016 election. Horrible as she is, warmonger though she is, Wall Street shill though she is, I agree with all those characterizations of Hillary Clinton. The same tricks and tactics were used to steal the election for Donald Trump, who had no idea he was going to win, that had been used the previous spring and summer to steal the Democratic Party nomination from Bernie Sanders, who actually should be president now. He would have beaten Trump. He certainly beat Hillary. 11 primaries were stolen from him, okay? So, you know, what the Supreme Court did yesterday was simply a more in-your-face move in the direction of completely nullifying American elections, which are, and this is going to sound hyperbolic, but it isn't, the worst in the developed world. Our voting system is the most corrupt in the developed world. That is the finding of an annual study that's done by Harvard and the University of Sydney, where they rank voting systems worldwide, and the U.S. is 26th out of 26. We have a laughable voting system. And you know who has the best one, according to those institutions? Venezuela. They have the most honest, trustworthy election system in the world, okay? And yet now we're being told that Maduro stole the election and so on. So, you know, we're about to pull a Chile on that country, right? So, I mean, I could go on and on like this. In fact, I do often. The lies are so big and dangerous that one must speak out against them however one can. And one must also champion the cause of Julian Assange and call for his liberation and the restoration of his access to the internet, because he is a champion of the truth, and what's happening to him is a crime.
Mark Crispin Miller, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. We'll have you back. Okay. Thank you again.
It'll be a pleasure to come back. Thanks.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Like the USA, Israel is a colonial settler state which, beginning in 1948, 70 years ago, expelled 750,000 native Palestinians, took their land, homes, and businesses, and reduced those who remained to abused second-class citizens, not unlike what was done to Native Americans by white settlers in the USA, where their land was stolen, their tribes uprooted, and their culture practically destroyed. In 1967, Israel expanded further, militarily occupying Palestinian territories to their north, east, and south, including East Jerusalem. Last month, attorney and Columbia law professor Catherine Franke, the chair of the Board of Trustees of the Center for Constitutional Rights, along with attorney Vince Warren, the CCR's executive director, headed up a 20-person delegation of American activists who traveled to Israel to report on the human rights situation there. Franke and Warren never made it past the airport in Tel Aviv. They were stopped, questioned, detained for 14 hours, and then deported back to the USA. Frankie was told she could never return. Protest against and publicity about the Israeli government's action took place in Israel and in the United States. It's been dramatic. We speak today with Attorney Frankie about the delegation, what they saw and heard, and the reaction to her expulsion both here and in Israel. Catherine Frankie is a professor of law at Columbia University Law School and the director of the Center for Gender and Sexuality Law. She is the author of Wedlocked, The Perils of Marriage Equality. Her next book will be coming out from Haymarket Press in the spring. It's called Repair, Slavery's Unfinished Business. The book makes the case for racial reparations in the United States. Catherine Frankie, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Michael, it's so great to see you.
Catherine, who organized the delegation and who were some of the members?
The delegation was organized by the Center for Constitutional Rights. It's the second kind of delegation like this that we've done. And the aim of this trip was to bring together civil and human rights advocates from the United States who work in a range of contexts to see the similarities between the work that they do in the U.S. and what's going on in Israel and the occupied territories. So we had people who had worked at Standing Rock around Native American rights to land and the sacredness of land and water. We had people who had been advocates working in Ferguson, people that had been working in Puerto Rico around all of the, you know, horrendous things that have been going on in Puerto Rico, and a range of other advocates that came from a very diverse set of civil rights contexts. And what I found, what I learned from the delegation, I wasn't there, of course, but what I learned from the delegates was just amazing connections that they saw between the work they do here and what's going on in Israel and in the West Bank.
I want to get into that in a moment, but let's go back to the airport for a second. You were stopped. And what wrongdoings were you accused of?
Well, I had actually cleared immigration, as had Vince Warren, who was with me, the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And we were waiting for one more member of the delegation to get through immigration. All the rest of the delegates had already left the airport and had boarded a bus on the way to Jerusalem to start the trip. And as we were waiting for this other delegate, she finally came out. I had been texting with her, and I knew she was being interrogated in a kind of preliminary way by the immigration officials. But she came out accompanied by an immigration official, and that official dragged all of us back into the secure zone behind passport control. And we sat for hours before we were interrogated. I had no idea what it was they had accused us of. But as I learned during my own interrogation, which lasted about an hour, they suspected that I was a leader of Jewish Voice for Peace, JVP, and that I was a leader of the BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement in the United States. And neither of those things are true, really. But even if they were, I don't think those are proper grounds for me to be excluded from entry into Israel.
Catherine, who singled you out at the airport?
Well, it actually was kind of a mistake that I got dragged into this because I'd already cleared passport control. So it was only because they decided that I was associated with this other delegate who they had decided was a left activist coming to the country to criticize Israel, which actually wasn't true. But they associated me with her. And as they were asking me questions during my interrogation, they Googled me on the man who was talking to me, Googled me on his phone and held it up. And there was a picture from what I know is Canary Mission, which is a trolling right-wing Zionist website that goes after the people who are human rights advocates who have a critique of Israel's human rights record. And he held it up to me and he said, "See, you've been lying to me. You're a leader of JVP and you're here to promote BDS in Israel." And I said, "I'm not a leader. I don't work for JVP, although I do sometimes volunteer with them. And I'm not here to promote BDS. In my view, BDS is something you do elsewhere. You don't do it in Israel." And I said, "No, I'm here on a tour. I'm here to see the sites in Israel." And he said, "No, you're lying. You're making my job easy for me," and was really yelling at me at that point. The interrogation became abusive at that point.
Well, I have to express some solidarity. Just as an aside, Catherine, I'm also on the list of Canary Mission. It's a proud list. 16 of the 20 members of your delegation did get into Israel. What did they find?
Well, they met with a number of human rights groups within Israel, groups that do advocacy domestically, both for the Arab minority within Israel, the citizens of Israel who are of Palestinian descent, but also around a range of other issues. There are African refugees who were in Israel who were being treated horribly and are being deported.
And there are Jews as
yes.
well amongst these
yes,
people.
Yes, these are yes. Jews. African Jews who were admitted into Israel legally and are now being deported as a kind of ethnic cleansing that's yeah. going on by the Israelis. And then they also met with some domestic groups within Israel who were working in the Negev, which is in the southern desert area where the Israeli government is evicting Bedouins from their homes, from their communities, bulldozing those communities, and then building on top of them Jewish-only communities. And so the treatment of the Bedouins within Israel itself in many ways mirrors what's happening in the West Bank to Palestinians who are being dispossessed of their land as well. And so the group also met with several civil rights groups and human rights groups within the West Bank.
Talk about boycott, divestment, and sanction. What are its three goals? Obviously, I think you're going to tell us that you support them. And what is the Israeli government, what have they been doing to people who support those goals?
Well, a number of years ago, Palestinian civil society organizations within the West Bank and Gaza came together and decided to make a call to the international community to express solidarity with their sovereignty struggle by endorsing the boycott of the State of Israel, sanctions to be imposed against the State of Israel by other nations, and then divestment of in companies that are part of the occupation or part of the infrastructure of surveillance of Palestinians, very similar to the BDS call that was used by the ANC, the African National Congress, as they were fighting the apartheid regime in South Africa. This call for BDS has been very successful internationally. It has put an enormous amount of pressure on the Israeli government, and the government is very, very worried about it. So they've done a number of things, one of which is issue a campaign, a kind of media campaign, to label anybody who endorses BDS as anti-Semitic, to collapse the idea of being a critic of the human rights policies or abuses of a government with a hatred towards the people who make up the majority of the citizens in that country. And obviously, there's quite a bit of room between being anti-Semitic on the one hand and being critical of the Israeli government on the other. And another thing that they've done is pass a law that would deny entry to the State of Israel of anyone who has publicly endorsed the boycott. So my deportation, as well as some of the other members of the delegation, was part of that law that was passed this last year as part of Israel's efforts to defeat the BDS movement internationally.
And the goals of the BDS movement?
The goals of the BDS movement are threefold. The first is that Palestinians living within Israel itself be treated equally as citizens of Israel along with Jewish citizens of Israel. The second is that Palestinians be restored the land that they were dispossessed from in 1947 and 48, and then the ongoing dispossession of land. And then thirdly, that Palestinians in the diaspora be allowed to return to Israel and or to a state, a Palestinian state or territory. So those are the three primary goals.
So when you got back to New York, you got quite a lot of publicity over what happened to you. Talk about that, please.
Well, it was, I have to say, we were detained for 14 hours in the airport, moved, shuttled from one place to another, and Vince Warren from CCR, who I was with, was actually taken off-site to a locked detention facility and put in a cell for a good part of the time that we were there at the airport. I was not, for reasons that were not obvious at all. It's a lot of what happened to us seemed kind of random. But Vince actually suffered more than I did in terms of his detention. You know, he's an African-American man, and being thrown in a prison, I think, has serious consequences for a person and implications for a person like Vince.
Let me just say as an aside, I was there on a delegation from the National Lawyers Guild in 1985, and one of our members was Wilhelm Joseph, who was the head of the National Conference of Black Lawyers, quite a distinguished-looking African-American man, actually African-Caribbean, but has been living here. And when we were leaving, not coming in, but leaving, he was surrounded by Israeli security forces. Who had been following him throughout the time he was in the country. So even going back 33 years ago. But in any case, let's talk about who came to your defense. Groups, professors, media, any politicians?
Well, when we returned, we kind of had to regroup. It was a bit disorienting to be held in the airport that long. But to my great delight and surprise, unprompted by myself, over 80 faculty at Israeli universities, law faculty at Israeli universities, representing every single one of the universities in Israel, some of which are quite conservative, signed a letter condemning our deportation and condemning the idea that a democracy would exclude from entry a person or scholar like myself based on my political views and my scholarship. So that was one letter that came out. A second did from Jewish law professors within the United States. A third by Jewish studies professors in the U.S., and then there was also a petition at Columbia as well. And I have to say, I solicited none of this. It was quite humbling, really, to see the academic community come together uniformly condemning the idea that a state that calls itself a democracy would actually operate the airport as a checkpoint, as a larger part of the occupation by keeping out scholars like myself.
Israel passed a law in 2017, barring the entry of foreign supporters of the BDS movement. Last January, Israel published a blacklist of 20 human rights organizations whose members would be banned from Israel. They say that BDS is a threat to their national security. Would you agree with me that the real threat to Israel's national security is their continual abuse of native populations and their participation in the destabilization of surrounding countries?
I think that's right, Michael. Israel's treatment of the Palestinians and African Jews who've come to the country seeking refuge and their own record of denying civil rights to a range of people within Israel itself have created serious security problems for the country. And then, ironically, they've outsourced much of their security screening at the airport to trolling right-wing Zionist websites like Canary Mission or Amcha, which is how I got trapped at the airport, was based on the Google search. I think it's important to recognize that the treatment that we received at the airport in Tel Aviv was not exceptional. Actually, it was a symptom of a larger way in which the state of Israel is managing populations, limiting their ability to travel, using ideological criteria for allowing people to meet with one another. Part of why I was going to Israel and to the West Bank was to meet with people in the West Bank who can't leave. Scholars, I have a graduate student whose dissertation I'm supervising. She can't get a permit to leave Ramallah to come meet with me. You know, I'm lucky I can go home, get on a plane and go home. But so many Palestinians are trapped in the West Bank and even more so in Gaza. So the experience I had, while unfortunate, pales compared to the daily forms of violence, indignity, limits on travel, interrogation, and occupation. So I want to be clear with our listeners that I'm certainly offended by what happened to me, but it's a small piece of what daily Palestinians experience at the hands of the Israeli government.
Attorney Catherine Franke, unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our allotted time. But before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about laws penalizing BDS here in the United States. One law, for example, was introduced at a national level, and it contains a penalty of a fine of up to $1 million and imprisonment for up to 20 years. Do you think that the Israeli lobby in the United States is behind this? And isn't a boycott a form of free speech?
Well, the simple answer to your question is yes. There is a very well-financed campaign, not just by the Israeli government, but by the State of Israel's friends within the United States, to pass laws on the municipal, state, and federal level that punish anybody who endorses the boycott. The Governor Cuomo signed an executive order in New York saying that they will not allow any contracts or spending of state money with any company or institution or organization that has endorsed the boycott or sanctions or divestment from Israel. So, for instance, the Presbyterian Church cannot get state money in New York to run a homeless shelter because they have divested from companies that play a role in the settlements in the West Bank. This kind of political activity, the endorsement of a boycott, divestment, and sanctions, is absolutely protected by the First Amendment. Boycotts played an important part in the toolkit of every civil rights movement and every human rights movement, really, since go back in the United States to the Tea Party before our founding. That was a boycott. The Montgomery bus boycott is obviously one of the most famous boycotts as part of the civil rights movement in the 60s. So there's nothing new that's happening with this boycott that would render it different from boycotts that have been used in prior eras. And indeed, ironically, Alan Dershowitz's brother was one of the authors of a brief to the Supreme Court in the 60s that defended the right to a boycott for civil rights activists in Montgomery and elsewhere. So you can't say that this is somehow a dirty trick motivated by some hatred of Jews to engage in a boycott when this is a tried and true tactic. A peaceful tactic, I would add, that pretty much every civil rights movement has used.
Catherine, before we let you go, how can people follow your work?
They can follow me on Twitter. My handle on Twitter is at Prof. K. Franke, K-F-R-A-N-K-E. I do a lot of work on Twitter there. We have a blog at Columbia University, Center for Gender and Sexuality Law blog. I do have a life outside of the work around Palestine and Israel that deals with gender and sexuality law, legal issues. And I've got a new book coming out, and I'm looking forward to coming back on the show and talking about it next spring.
What's the name of the book?
Repair, Slavery's Unfinished Business, and I make the case for racial reparations.
We'll see you back on the show, if not before. Catherine Franke, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael. Great to see you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web.